Welcome to the Company and Markets podcast. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the company's editor of the IC. Joining me today is our news editor, Bradley Gerrard. How are you doing, Bradley?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
It's been a busy week, though results season is dying down a bit now.
That's true, yeah, it's been very busy. Lots of results in the mag this week.
Exactly right. Also joining us is our deputy company's editor, Mark Robinson. Mark, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Ian.
And you've written about half the magazine this week, Mark.
It's been a productive week, but hopefully quality will outlast quantity in this case.
And over in the control room, we have our digital editor, Graham Davis. Graham, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Ian.
Thanks for joining us.
It's been a while.
Yes, thanks for coming back. Okay, well, let's start off with Brussels. I don't know where else to start, really. It's been another sombre week for anyone in Europe, and it's been reflected on the markets too. Bradley, you have written about some of the travel stocks that have been affected by the latest attacks.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the market as a whole kind of fell a bit yesterday morning in the initial wake of the attacks. And travel stocks, obviously, potentially most sort of going to be most affected by this event, because it will inevitably have an impact on the desire of people to travel. And actually looking at how far the stocks fell, there were more of them fell a sort of a greater amount than after the Paris attacks, actually.
And you actually identified in the news piece that you wrote a couple of the airlines that had viewed Belgium as a growth opportunity for their kind of coverage. So yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryanair and TUI, kind of in their most recent results, did mention Brussels, not as the only country, but as a country in which they were looking to grow their presence. And they saw it as an important country to be present in, not only for, you know, people from the UK flying there, but also the Belgian tourist industry itself. So, you know, serving Belgians who want to go on holiday via, you know, other locations in Europe or Africa or wherever it might be. And also actually Peter Fankhauser, who's the chief executive of Thomas Cook, they issued a trading statement yesterday morning. And he was actually saying in that statement that he's sort of visibly seeing people delaying their decision to book a summer holiday, and his company's summer bookings are only at 40% at the moment, which is below the same time last year. So it's likely, or there's a potential that this latest attack might put that decision of some people whether to go on holiday off completely, or might delay it so much further.
And this isn't the first we've heard of that, right? This seems to be an ongoing theme, and a totally understandable theme that people are reticent to travel given the events.
Exactly. I mean, after Paris, there were a few trading updates and results from airlines. And one of the things that the EasyJet chief executive actually said was that, you know, travel is relatively robust and it does bounce back. But obviously, this attack coming just a few months after Paris is not going to be very welcome.
Well, we've had a succession, really, when you think about it as well. There's Tunisia and then Sharm el Sheikh. The list goes on. I guess after a while, it cements people's fears.
Well, exactly. And I mean, a lot of the airlines kind of after things like you say, like Sharm, and there was a bomb in Turkey in October as well. You know, the airlines kind of were able to react a little bit to that and sort of move capacity to serve the greater demand for things like Spain and the islands of Spain. But with a sort of attack on sort of, you know, central European soil, maybe Spain might be a little less attractive itself now, even given its proximity. It will very likely have an impact on the travel stocks, you'd have thought. Then you've also got the issue of for the travel stocks, the issue of the weakness of sterling as well, as the Brexit debate kind of creeps up on us.
No, exactly right, and we'll be returning to that, I'm sure. Our editor John Heumann also talked about Brussels in his editorial this week and mentioned the price of gold, which has jumped, and the gold miners, obviously, also with the impact of operational leverage, the share prices have also jumped this year. So yeah, we've seen reverberations very much in the markets. Okay, well, what else have we got in 7 days? Sports Direct, there's been quite a lot going on there.
Yeah, once again, it's very well-known founder, Mike Ashley, gave an interview to The Times, and his comments were widely reported in other media outlets. I mean, effectively, you could argue he wasn't really saying anything we didn't already know. I mean, the company had issued a trading update in January and had said that it would expect profits to be lower than initially guided. But the comments coming just this week, you know, he basically said the company can't be as profitable as it was last year, and that sent the shares down further again yesterday. So we had the company on a buy for a while, and we moved to a hold.
There was a succession of negative headlines.
Yeah, there was. We moved to hold, I think, around sort of like January kind of time, actually, just around the time of the profit warning. Christmas, they had a terrible Christmas with mainly for bad PR. And yeah, since then the shares have really not performed very well at all.
Isn't this potentially a big governance concern as well, if you're giving what looks like a profit warning to a national newspaper in advance of the market? But what you're saying is perhaps we already knew a lot of the stuff he was saying, so that might be a bit unfair.
Yeah, I mean, as we knew an element of it. They had warned in January already, so you could argue he was just really kind of repeating the message that was in that. But
they did put out a clarifying statement saying that following what he said, and just to guide them, that the profits will be at the bottom of the range that they had previously given.
Yeah, exactly. So there is that clarification, and maybe to sort of prevent the potential view, like you just said, that this was potentially a, you know, sort of a market moving comment. But he was really, I suppose, just kind of highlighting what the company had said in January. But obviously when it's said in an official statement, obviously it has an impact, but it's arguably a bit worse when you've got the founder repeating it to a national newspaper with the comments then repeated again throughout the whole of the national media. So,
and even worse, he said that he wished he'd never bought Newcastle United and he wished he'd never got into football. So really serious issues there.
Well, I think, I mean, the fans of Newcastle United might have their own view on Mike Ashley as well. But, you know, Sports Direct is a funny one. I mean, a lot of the sentiment around the shares has certainly waned sort of in the past few months because of sort of mainly PR, really. You know, the company's been fighting on all fronts to sort of bash off negative stories about the pay, working conditions, that type of thing. But I guess now the problem is that it looks like there are sort of more fundamental problems with the business, especially if the chief executive is very honestly, which is a good thing, I suppose, management to be, but very honestly saying really what the prognosis is for this year.
They should have a bit of a fillip from the European Football Championships this year, right? But that's really one of the few upside hopes at the moment.
Yeah, potentially. And that is potentially true, but I think there are probably a few more types of businesses which could benefit ahead of something like a clothing retailer, such as the gambling stocks, maybe even the pub groups. I mean, people going out and watching the football. I mean, it's more likely that will happen than you'll go out and buy a tracksuit because England are playing. I mean, okay, if England get very far, then maybe, you know, I'll retract that statement and we'll be wearing England shirts again.
We are all wearing tracksuits, actually, on this podcast.
I didn't want to disclose that, but anyway. I think there could be a boost, I suppose, from the European Championships, but I think it's quite a sort of far-out thing to expect.
Let's talk about one of your companies, Young's. The chief executive will be stepping down after nearly two decades.
Yeah, exactly. Stephen Goodyear, he's been with the pub group, or he's been sort of involved in pub groups for a very long time. He worked for Courage before joining Young's, and he'd worked at Courage for best part of two decades. And he's been at Young's for a pretty long time as well. He's going to be sort of moving on to the non-exec side of things. The shares, they haven't really sort of reacted massively negatively. I think that's because obviously they're handing over the reins to their sort of head of retail, basically, who, you know, Patrick Dardis, who's been with the group a fair while. So there isn't sort of a massive shock. Mr. Goodyear's 61 this year, so you might expect him to take a bit of a back seat.
So it's a fairly predictable business model as well, Young's, I think.
Yeah, they're very, very London focused, very rugby focused. Yeah. A lot of their pubs are very geared into sort of getting that rugby crowd in, which is arguably a little bit niche, I suppose. But as you say, they do it very well. And as a fan of rugby, Mark, I'm sure you're aware of a Young's pub or two.
Absolutely, absolutely. A little bit too often, I think. Okay, and it's been a good company, you know.
Absolutely.
And we should just mention, while the changes at the top, we have also covered Sir Andrew Whitty stepping down at GSK, but we've discussed that before, so perhaps we can move swiftly on and just mention RBS on the dividend. So, what's going on there? They've paid some money back to the government.
Yeah, basically, I mean, the simplest way to put it is, like you just said, they've effectively paid some money to the Treasury to enable them to be able to pay a dividend. So part of the rules of the state-backed rescue of the bank prevented RBS from paying dividends out until it was deemed to be in a sufficiently healthy position. So now they've been able to pay this £1.2 billion to the Treasury, which will enable them by rule of law, I suppose, to pay a dividend, although that's not expected to happen this year. It potentially could happen next year, the company says. But
and at the results, one of the big disappointments was that they pushed back any return of capital to beyond, I think it was the first quarter of 2017 at least.
Yeah.
So they may be able to do it on a kind of regulatory basis, but whether they're able to do it on a kind of capital basis is another matter.
Exactly. It's a technicality. I mean, arguably, if you're a bull of RBS, then you'll see this as another step along the road, which can only be seen as positive. But like you say, it's not as if RBS is throwing off excess cash. So the reality of actually paying a dividend, we're still waiting to see.
I think we're going to treat the listeners by not mentioning the budget because it's mostly political machinations rather than anything that really affects companies and the fallout from George Osborne's budget. But Graham, you've written about tungsten this week. Interesting bit going on behind the scenes there, or very much actually on stage in terms of Eddie Truell, the founder, who has been looking to kind of get more control over the business that he founded. Tell us what's going on there.
It's an intriguing situation. Eddie Truell, who's known in the city for his time at Duke Street Capital, he's been around the city for a long time, and tungsten's been quite a headline grabber since it floated at 225p a couple of years back, nearly 3 years ago now. It does electronic invoicing and has had some pretty impressive claims to have the capacity to process billions and billions of invoices, and those claims made it very popular with investors to begin with, and sent the shares up from 225p to nearly £4.
But that addressable market didn't seem to materialise so quickly.
Didn't quite materialise, and they branched out. They looked at launching a sort of banking operation, and then there was a bit of controversy around the shares. There was a short selling episode which hammered the shares. The shares were as low as 30p last year. Now Mr. Truell shifted from chief exec to a non-exec role, I believe, late last year.
And also put a fair amount of his own money in to try and shore up the shares.
Exactly.
And backers within the city.
We've regularly written about his director's dealings. He's been buying shares. He owns about 17% of the company now. But it transpires that over the past few months, he has made representations to the board in terms of some sort of corporate deal, the last of which happened last Saturday, when he suggested that he could take some of the assets of Tungsten and fold them into some other businesses that he's got interest in, one of which is a telematics business called Tantalum. The board rejected this with a rather damning description of the offer being universally without merit for shareholders.
Not with no merit anywhere in the universe.
And Mr. Truell resigned from the board. So it's a funny one. You get the impression that with the stake that he's got, he's not going to go away quietly from this one. There are suggestions that it may be from without the board, he could maybe make a hostile move. Who knows? But the issue here for shareholders is he wasn't actually offering to buy the company out and buy the shares. He wanted to take some of the assets, fold them into another one of his businesses, which would then leave Tungsten being an investment company, basically, with an interest in this wider business. So it's a slightly convoluted situation.
Which you've done a very good job of explaining.
Well, I hope so.
It's something we'll continue to follow because it's not going to be the end of that one.
It's definitely worth keeping an eye on because you get the sense there's going to be more action there.
Okay, and just finally, we have one of our longer news analysis pieces this week, Mark, that you've written about China. You've said, forget Brexit, the headline goes, China is the real concern. And you've seen signs in the property market that are reminiscent of the US bubble prior to 2008.
Well, that was my conclusion as well. That was one of the chief political economic advisors in China. And he's drawn sort of parallels between what's happening now in China with the subprime crisis in the US. And it's linked to the fact that the expansion of the shadow banking system, an increasing number of Chinese home buyers are actually accessing peer-to-peer lending and the other different types of organizations that have sprung up since the market was liberalized or opened up to a certain extent. Now, what it's transferred into is that we now have home buyers in China that are going in with no deposit, no visible means of support, income, savings.
Why does that sound familiar?
It does sound terribly familiar. Perhaps the one thing that counts against this is that the paucity of Chinese economic statistics. We don't really, or we can't get a reliable handle on just how many mortgagees are out there now. We're just going on reports that we've seen. But it's the nature of the lending as much as anything else that's going to raise some eyebrows. And plus, I made the point about Brexit earlier in the article, because obviously that does lead into some instability in the markets, but I think it's been overcooked. You know, you've had the CBI coming out against it, and also people like Mark Carney. But actually, I think China is the real looming problem. Some of some of those anxieties were taken away in the early part of this year, or from January onwards, really, when we saw a bit of a rebound in commodity markets that's accelerated during the second quarter. But really, this is fundamentally a result of the Chinese state bank laying off US dollar denominated assets. And this has the effect of undermining the value of the greenback. And of course, there's that negative correlation with the commodity prices that the US dollar exhibits. So that's the reason, that's the main reason why we've seen an uptick in commodity markets, with the possible exception of oil. But even that feeds into the oil price bounce too.
Which is a perfect link to our feature this week that you've had a big hand in, which is about oil survivors. So we've talked a lot on this podcast, and we've written a fair amount about all the trials of the oil market. But what you've tried to do in this feature is identify those companies that will make it through the current turbulence. What kind of metrics have you used, or what kind of factors have you looked at in terms of companies you think might be resilient?
Well, it relates, a lot of it actually relates to balance sheet stability. The fact that all of these companies that we have mentioned, with the exception of the oil service providers there, have existing production and also have some production in the offing. Alex Newman and myself have gone through and just we've taken a less scientific approach, if you like. We're just looking at balance sheet stability, really, and the ability of these companies to generate returns in a low price climate. Because we, even though the oil price has come back over the last couple of weeks, we don't see markets beginning to move towards equilibrium until the third quarter of this year at the earliest. And they're not going to achieve equilibrium at that point, but they'll start moving that way. So companies that have existing production, a low cost base, balance sheet that isn't overly leveraged, there were some of the main reasons that we picked out a few of these companies. And Alex has run the rule over companies like the two majors, BP and Royal Dutch Shell as well.
But also what was quite interesting here, in terms of protecting that dividend, you and Alex judge that potentially one of the companies least likely to cut its dividend is not based in the UK, it's a US company. ExxonMobil.
The point is, Exxon is the largest public oil company in the world now, and the main point about that is they've got a very strong balance sheet, and one of the reasons we looked at that is because they're in a prime position to hoover up distressed assets now that a lot of hedges have come off from production. In the North Sea, in the Middle East, and also small to medium-sized companies that actually are struggling under the weight of their balance sheets. It's going to be easy meat for a company like Exxon as well.
It's managed to maintain its profitability.
It has. I mean, it's a full-stage integrated player, really. And we've always liked it just in terms of its stability as well. But we've also picked a couple of unlikely options in the field of oilfield services. Amec Foster Wheeler, a company that has got into trouble because of the fall away in capital budgets in the oil industry, and they cut their dividend rate last year, and the focus is purely on reducing their leverage levels, their level of leverage at the moment.
Given that and cutting the dividend pay rate, why are you more confident when it comes to Amec Foster Wheeler?
Because the price has come off quite a bit, but we like its long term prospects anyway, because it just doesn't serve solely the oil and gas markets. It's also got considerable exposure to nuclear markets and other forms of engineering too. And with them, we just thought it was a case of bad timing. They'd incorporated the Foster Wheeler Group from the US, and then oil prices clicked firmly into reverse. We also mentioned Gulf Marine Services, and it's a company that we've always liked because of the business mix. I mean, they have just come out these last few days and delivered a profit warning for next year based on a margin squeeze, because the new business that they're attracting at the moment, it's a buyer's market out there, and so their clients are coming back to them and saying, well, we can afford this over the coming months. I mean, that shouldn't have been much of a surprise to the market in a sense, but what we do like about them is their business mix, which is based largely in the Middle East and largely in relation to OPEX costs and largely to do with national oil companies, where the revenue streams are far more predictable, albeit at a lower margin. Faroe Petroleum is another one we like as well, without going right through the list here. It's a smaller producer, fantastic balance sheet at the moment. It's got production, it's got existing production, a low-cost production at that. It's got an interesting exploration program for this year, and plus it's based in Norwegian waters as well, so it gets the requisite tax benefits of being in that locale.
If I can put you on the spot, one question that our readers or listeners might ask is, of the two majors in the UK, Shell and BP, which one would you most credit as a potential oil survivor, or are you confident on both?
Less so with BP. I mean, the operation is going to pack up tomorrow, but it still hasn't. Most of the Macondo costs are behind it now, and most are included on the balance sheet, and so we've got some clarity there. But I just tend to prefer Shell's mix now that the BG merger or takeover has gone through, because it's a good long-term strategic move, I think, because LNG is likely to be a more predictable and profitable end of the oil and gas market in years to come. And they've incorporated some of the best assets around that BG have in the Bowen Basin in Australia. And plus their offshore oil finds in the Santos region of Brazil. Or, you know, there was some justified worries over the ability of BG to get the requisite kit out to their offshore plays in the Santos Basin, but because of Shell's involvement, we now think that's less likely that they'll be affected by the Petrobras scandal.
And when it comes to BP, you have written about the decline in the reserves replenishment ratio. Why is that an important ratio?
Well, it's
as it sounds.
Well, exactly. I mean, they've trimmed their capital budgets, and therefore, exploration has fallen, and they haven't been able to replenish the barrels that they've sold over the last year, and it was the same case with Shell as well. I mean, and over time, if that keeps up, then obviously your reserve base diminishes, the value of the company goes down. So it's a standard metric. There's not a problem at the moment, because while this present oil price slump has dragged on since midway through 2014, it's not long enough to put a real dent in reserves. But we'll be looking at that at the half year mark and also the full year mark for these companies as well, because that can't be allowed to go on. But the focus is on shoring up balance sheets and freeing up free cash flow in order that they might finance their dividends. And that's what's happened. But this capital pullback can't, it's unsustainable over the long run.
Thanks a lot, Mark. And I would commend anyone to read the full feature. It really just kind of cut through a lot of the noise around the oil market at the moment and had some actionable tips in there. And finally, Mark, I'm not going to let you alone, because we thought we'd finish with something sweet,
yes,
which is right at the end of the magazine.
Right in time for Easter as well.
Right on time for Easter. We have a sex focus on the confectionery market.
Yeah, the confectionery market with a specific focus on chocolate and chocolatiers, because it was inspired by the imminent debut of Hotel Chocolat. That's coming up. It's attracted quite a bit of interest in the financial pages, and from what we hear, a lot of interest from retail investors as well.
Are you a fan personally?
I am a fan personally. I don't have much of a sweet tooth, to be honest. But
Bradley, Hotel Chocolat?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah, happy with that. Graham?
Big fan, yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, what's your favourite? Is there a favourite type
of
it?
They do these big slabs of chocolate about that thing.
A slab?
You build your house out of it?
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, but although we've had the London listing, this is very much a European sector.
Yeah, most of the big players out there are based in Europe, in the Low Countries. but also in Germany and France as well. Not all of them are listed, and some of the larger ones are people that you've never actually heard of. But it's a thematic piece, really, and I was looking at even a company like Fever-Tree Drinks as being similar to Hotel Chocolat, because what it does reflect is the changing sort of palates, the increased sophistication, if you like, of palates in the UK, and it's opened up opportunities. I mean, if you would have asked someone to pay, I don't even know what a bottle of Fever-Tree Tonic is, but I know it's far more expensive than the standard brand, without mentioning
names. A couple of quid. That's like asking a politician how much is a pint of milk, isn't it? How much is a bottle
of Fever-Tree? How much is a gin and tonic? You probably have a bit of a chance.
A couple of quid,
really,
isn't it?
And the point is, it feeds into this long-term theme that investors like Jim Rogers have been beating the drum about for years, about foodstuffs, and over the long term, this is going to provide real returns for investors. And I tend to agree. But I also think that you've got to look at the value-added end of the market as well. And some of the interesting points about chocolate itself, it's not dissimilar to tobacco, gambling, or liquor, because it's got defensive qualities. And when you look at because it's expanded and it's a global industry now, the chocolate demand tends to be inelastic. So what that means is, regardless of if you get fallaways or price increases, people will still buy chocolate. It's a bit like coffee in that regard. But by the same token, studies have shown that once you get a general increase in incomes in a given economy, especially Western economies, I think I quote somewhere that if you were to get a 10% increase in the United States in median incomes, then chocolate consumption or cocoa consumption goes up by nearly the same rate, 9.3%. So it suggests that It wins out on both ends. It's defensive, but it also moves in line with incomes. And when we see the growth of incomes, particularly in Asian markets, that's where all the growth is coming from in the chocolate industry. So I've mentioned a few different plays on this, but it's just an interesting one, I think, for people's portfolios to be treated in much the same way as the sin stocks.
And very prescient as well, with the sugar level coming in. And actually, next week's Sex Focus, Bradley, you're writing, which will be looking at the impact of the sugar levy on drinks companies, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. You're looking at that, the potential impact on the companies, as you say, analysing the brands a bit of the main sort of beverage companies, and also looking at some alternative ways to play the beverage sector if this sugar tax scares you off.
Very good. Well, you can look forward to that. Well, there's plenty more in the magazine, Diary of a Private Investor, The Best Funds for Euro QE, and much more. £4.70 in all good newsagents. See you next week.